Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. Jamie here with John in a doozy of a case. What's up, John?
Dude, I am, you said what's up, not how am I doing? I always
answer
get the
either way.
Up.
It's okay. Same sentiment.
I am doing great, and there's not a whole lot going on other than we have a case that I am just pumped about. This is, I don't know, it's gruesome, it's awful, but it's very interesting. So I'm really excited. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. Things are rolling. Things are good. A lot of podcast production happening in this room, so having a good time with that. I don't often read these, John, but I'm going to today. You can't review podcasts over on Spotify, but you can leave a comment, and we get them regularly. But this one I wanted to read.
Okay.
This is going to count as our review for today. So this is from Carmelita A.
Carmelita.
This is one of the best episodes yet. The banter between you two is usually so good, but today was amazing. Well done. Wish I could give you a galaxy of stars.
Oh,
that was from the Charles Harrelson video from last week.
Oh, hey, I got an update on that case.
Yeah, you do.
So I mentioned that I have a good friend of mine who used to work at the Colorado Supermax prison where Charles was held. And I mentioned on the air, I wonder if he was the one who found Charles dead. And after we recorded that, I ended up talking to my friend, and he was the officer who found Charles deceased in his bed.
How insane is that?
Wild.
Absolutely crazy.
He said that he had just started. It was like his second month on the job, and he had just transferred to that unit, and he was doing his morning time checks right before breakfast. And he told Charles to get up for breakfast, and Charles didn't move. And then he had to be a little bit more forceful and say, get up,
yeah.
Time for breakfast. Charles didn't move. Then he noticed that he was purple and not breathing.
Yeah.
So how crazy is that, that one of my best friends was the one who found Charles Harrelson?
Yeah, that's absolutely an insane connection and a crazy story. So we're glad you appreciated that too, Carmelita.
Carmelita,
thanks for the galaxy of stars. That made me so happy.
What a writer, man. I wish I could give you a galaxy full of stars.
Also, she really set us up for your banter is usually good, but but it was amazing.
That was a roller coaster.
Yeah, I thought it was going to go a different direction.
That might be the nicest thing someone has said to me all year.
There you go. I mean, it's first week of January.
I'm talking about 2023 as well.
There you go. We appreciate you, Carmelita. But today's case also will not disappoint. If you like that one, I think you're going to love this one.
Before we jump into that, I do want to remind you, we put out a bonus episode on Patreon each and every month on the first day of the month. So if you haven't signed up yet, go over there, patreon.com, search for us, True Crime Cast, and you can find almost 7 years worth of bonus material. And as if that isn't enough, you also get our main feed brought to you a day early and ad free over on patreon.com. So go check that out. We haven't raised prices the entire time we've been doing Patreon. So, and we don't have plans on doing so. So go check it out. Inflation's not hurting you over there.
Absolutely, guys. Today we are going to go up to Indiana. Pretty all close right. to us. Close state. Can I get us rolling? Do you want to say it?
I mean, I want to say it. Why don't you get the ball rolling?
Thanks, buddy.
Thanks.
In the early 1980s, Kimberly Star Wren's best friend Marcy introduced her to David Cam. The two hit it off immediately, and they got together a whirlwind romance like you see in John Hughes movies, and they got married in May of 1989. They had several years of a happy marriage. David became a state trooper for a while. Kim went to work in an accounting job for a corporation. In 1993, they had their first kid. They had a son that they named Bradley.
Their family was happy and growing, but David had a wandering eye. Not that he had like a lazy or a cross-eye situation, but he was friends with a woman who worked at the gym that he went to named Stephanie McCarty. But after his son was born and Stephanie broke up with her boyfriend, David made a move. The two made very little attempts in order to hide their affair. So David took Stephanie out to dinner and to nightclubs while Kim was at home with their new baby, and she believed that her husband was at work. When Kim announced that she was pregnant again, Stephanie told David that their relationship was over, because it's obvious that you're being unfaithful to your wife and your girlfriend thinks you're being unfaithful to her because his wife is pregnant.
Yeah, there's always so much pain that comes with affairs, and obviously this hurts Kim and Stephanie, and I'm sure David would hurt as well, but some people would say that he may have deserved the pain that he got. I just want to note, we are going to talk about some infidelity that David had, and while that certainly doesn't make him guilty of anything he's accused of, it is an important part of the story and became a big part of the trial. So we feel like we need to cover that. Mackenzie sent that sentiment as well. She didn't want people to think that she just thought he was awful since he cheated, which maybe he is, but that didn't make him a killer. But Stephanie and David, their breakup didn't last. Soon they started to get together again. This time, though, Kim knew something was going on. She suspected that her husband was cheating and directly confronted him about it. When she did, David confessed. He told his wife, who was 5 months pregnant at the time, that he had been cheating on her and that he wanted a divorce because he wanted to marry Stephanie. He was in love with her and not Kim. Obviously, Kim was devastated. This is something that, I don't know, you never think will happen to you, and just the pain is unspeakable. She packed herself up. She packed up baby Bradley stuff, and she went to stay with her parents while they were going to proceed with separation and divorce. But the next morning, she angrily went back home and told David that he should be the one to move out. If he's going to cheat, if he's going to initiate the divorce, he needs to leave. I think that's a fair request from her, John, don't you?
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I mean, I don't know what David felt about that, but I get where she's coming from, and I would support that decision. So David did move out. He moved into an apartment, and then soon after that, Stephanie unofficially moved in with him. And when Kim gave birth to their daughter, Jill, on February 28th of 1995, Kim's parents and David's parents were there, but David was not there. So this has escalated to the point where he's not even there to see the birth of his child. And as a father myself, even if I'm upset with my wife for some reason, it's all about the kid. And I would want to be there, but I don't know. I've never been in David and Kim's situation, so I don't know that he would be welcome in the room when you're living with another woman, but I would want to be in the room.
Yeah, it's tough. I don't know. Of course, I couldn't be in Kim's position, but I would think you would want him to care about his child regardless of how you felt about him. And even if he wasn't in the delivery room, he could be in the waiting room.
Absolutely. But he wasn't even in the hospital, not even in the food court. Now, the following month, David and Stephanie had a fight, and this fight was about her talking to an ex-boyfriend, and this escalated to the point where Stephanie had to move out. And within hours of Stephanie leaving, David called Kim and said that he wanted to talk about getting back together with her. And Kim still loved David, even though this hurt was very real, so she ended up taking him back.
I'll always find it interesting when a couple separates due to an affair, and then the person they had an affair with is shocked that they have another affair.
Yeah.
Like you did this with them. You know what type of person they are. If somebody tells you what type of person they are, you should listen to them.
This is just, one of those situations. What is the phrase? Oh, the tangled webs we weave. Yeah. Like, this is just an awful family dynamic going on here, but it gets worse.
The family of four moved into a new house on Lockhart Road in Georgetown, Indiana. Kim was proud of her new home. She loved her husband. She felt like he had really changed, and she had two beautiful babies. David was spending a lot more time at home. He was spending a lot of time with his kids. But unfortunately, David continued to be tempted by other women. In June of 1997, just 2 years after he and Kim have gotten back together, David started having another affair with somebody named Michelle. This was an old friend of his that he reconnected with, and reconnected in a big way. When Michelle learned that David was married, she ended their relationship, which I think if you enter into a relationship with somebody and find out they're married, again, you should listen to who they're telling you they are, and she ended the relationship. But David had already found somebody else. He was having an affair with a woman named Lisa, so he was cheating on Michelle and Kim at the time. Lisa was a family friend who was also a friend to Kim, at least she pretended to be, and she was engaged to a local fireman.
So Lisa did end up getting married to the fireman, but when that relationship ended, David continued to move on to more and more women. But his career also took a downhill turn when he received several complaints about his involvement in a high-profile lawsuit where a 19-year-old claimed that he was assaulted by David and two other troopers during an arrest. Now, the state had to investigate this, and they cleared David of wrongdoing, but he was reassigned to casino duty, where he was going to be basically stationed at a casino and providing the security detail as a local law enforcement, or as a state trooper, rather. Now, David saw this as a demotion, and to cope with that, he continued to have one affair after the other. In 1999, David was sleeping with the wife of another friend and a former state trooper.
Yeah, he is obviously not learning his lesson here, and he's just created a mess for himself. David knew his career was on the decline. He had been demoted essentially to work at this casino, and he was feeling the pull to maybe settle down and finally just focus on his family, not to be ambitious in his career and ambitious with his sexual escapades. So in 2000, he decided that he was going to spend more time with his family, and he left his job with the Indiana State Police and went to work as a salesman at his uncle's company. David was staying loyal to his wife, his job made more money than a police officer did, and the family had a beautiful new home. Kim also had a great job working in corporate accounting, and everything seemed to have settled in the perfect family of four, happy family situation. Brad was a quiet kid, and he was a really talented swimmer. Baby Jill was a little fireball. She was funny. She always would find a way to get people's attention. Just the perfect little family of four. Everything was beautiful. It was like Pleasantville for the Cam family. We're going to take a break. When we get back, we'll talk about how the Cam family went from this dream scenario to a nightmare I would wish on nobody.
Guys, I want to tell you about a way that I was able to just come out on top of a really stressful situation. The first of the year is stressful. At work, I feel like everything is due at one time. And in years past, it's been kind of a nightmare. But this year, I'm drinking Magic Mind every morning to start my day. And the progress and, I don't know, just the efficiency that I've had this year doing all of my beginning of the year tasks has been night and day different. I love that I can do my job, get it done thoroughly and correctly, and feel stress-free while doing it. Jamie, I kind of attribute that to a lot of ingredients in Magic Mind, but especially the ashwagandha. I think it helps me so much.
This January only, you can get your gear up to crush your 2024 New Year's resolutions by getting 1 month free of Magic Mind when subscribing for 3 months. You can go to magicmind.com/JanTrueCrimeCast. That's JanTrueCrimeCast. And use code TrueCrimeCast at checkout. This gives you an extra 20% off, which is a total of 75% off of your purchase. This only lasts till the end of January, so hurry up before this goes away. Again, that's magicmind.com/JanTrueCrimeCast and use code TrueCrimeCast at checkout.
On September 28th, 2000, David left to play basketball at a nearby church at around 7 p.m. He came home later that night, and dude, he walked into a nightmare. David found his wife shot to death on the garage floor. As he approached the car, he saw Jill sitting upright in the back seat, still strapped in her seatbelt, also shot to death. Brad's body was draped over the back seat as if he was trying to get away, and he too had been shot to death. Kim was 35 years old, Brad was 7 years old, and Jill was just 5 years old.
So he walked back into the garage and found his whole family shot to death.
Yeah, and then immediately made a 911 call, and we have audio from that, so let's listen to that now.
NSA Police Radio, Patrice, can I help you?
Patrice, it's Dave Cam. Let me talk to Postman right now.
Okay, he's on another line.
Right now, let me talk to Postman.
Hold on.
You're my only truth. I need you like
Dave? Get everybody out here to my house now.
Okay, all right.
My wife and my kids are dead. Get everybody out here to my house.
Go to Dave Cam's house now. Signal 10. Okay, David, we got people on the way, okay?
Get everybody out here.
Come here.
Everything's going to be okay, all right? We're going to get people. Everything's not okay. Get everybody out here now.
They're coming. Go to Dave Cam's house now.
Okay.
Do you know what happened, David?
No. They're dead. I just got them from playing basketball.
4548 Ellisburg.
Oh, my God. What am I going to do? Andrew, get everybody out here.
David, they're on their way, right?
Wow, it's really hard to listen to. We often urge our listeners not to really read too much into somebody's reaction. You never know how people are going to react to an emergency, but the way that David reacted is how I think I would probably react if I walked onto this scene. When David got there, he immediately knew that Kim and Jill had been shot in the head and that they were both gone. They were passed away, but Brad didn't seem to have a head injury, so David thought that maybe Brad was still alive. He entered the passenger front side of the car, went through the bucket seats, and put his hand on Brad, and he said that he felt like he was still warm. He got him out, put him on the garage floor, and gave him CPR. In doing this, he also put his knee in the middle of the back seat, which caused Jill to slump forward and to lean over against David's shirt, obviously getting blood on it. Later, Brad was also found on the garage floor because that's where David got him out and placed him. Kim was also on the garage floor, and she had had her pants removed. She was only in her underwear. Her shoes and socks were removed and very carefully placed on the roof of their car, which is a very odd place to do that. People don't just put their shoes up there, so it seems like the killer likely did this. An autopsy later revealed that Jill and Kim have died of those gunshot wounds to the head, and Bradley had been shot through the torso, which severed his spine. 3 days after this, and several interviews with police later, David Cam was arrested for the murder of his wife and his two children.
There were a lot of false leads in this investigation, so the first theory police had was that David had come home from playing basketball, shot his family, tried to clean up a little bit before he called the police. A man named Robert Stites was a crime scene photographer who police believed was a blood spatter analyst who was at the scene of the crime. He told police that this was a cleanup at the crime scene, that somebody made it, I don't know, tried to clean up a little bit before they left or before calling the police. He also said that there was a high velocity impact spatter on David's shirt. So you mentioned that when he was kneeling in the back seat, her body grazed his shirt basically. But this expert is saying that no, that spatter came from the velocity, the impact of the bullet from being shot.
Yeah, shooting somebody at close range. Another piece of evidence that was presented and used against David was a phone bill showing that David had made a phone call from his house at 7:19 p.m. on the evening of the murder. And that's around the same time that he claimed that he was playing basketball. Police also knew David's history of infidelity, and they used that as his motive, that he wanted out of this situation so that he could continue to have affairs. And while the infidelity was true, the other pieces of evidence used on the probable cause affidavit were either inaccurate or unreliable. Based on autopsies, the time of death was determined to be around 8 p.m., and David was allegedly at basketball at the church from 7 to 9:30. And the phone call that seemed to show that David was at home also wasn't accurate. The phone company explained that because Indiana has strange time zones, Indiana is mostly on Eastern time, but there are 12 counties in the Northwest and Southwest that have remained or changed to Central Time. So Indiana split, and the 7:19 p.m. phone call was actually made at 6:19 p.m., which was before he left to go to basketball. So that being used as evidence against him was not reliable either.
The alleged cleanup was also disproven. It was not an attempted cleanup, but the usual separation of blood when it is exposed to air. But there was one big piece of evidence that was not examined thoroughly. In the garage, under Brad's body, was a gray sweatshirt with the name Backbone that was embroidered into the collar. The state lab analyzed the sweatshirt, and they found an unidentified female DNA on the front of the shirt. David's defense team hired a private lab and found unidentified male DNA on the collar. Kim's blood and DNA were also found on the same sweatshirt. Investigators and the prosecution team said that they ran the DNA through CODIS and came up with zero matches.
Yeah, just to have this shirt that didn't seem to belong to the Cam family is obviously indicative of somebody coming in from the outside, but they tried to explain this away as well. In David's trial in the spring of 2002, prosecutors focused on the blood spatter evidence on David's shirt and, again, focused on the infidelities as motive. They brought in a dozen women to testify that David had hit on them or had affairs with them. John, this is obviously what they used in trial, so it's relevant for us to talk about. But is this appropriate to be shared in court of just this long list of women that he was with to try to show the motive? It feels to me like a bit of overkill, or maybe, I don't know, too much to sensationalize what was happening.
I mean, I get it from the prosecution's angle. They're trying to let the jury know what his potential motive would have been. Like, this guy might have wanted his family to be gone so he could focus on one of these other women he was running around with. But if I'm a juror, I want to know, what physical evidence do you have tying him to the actual murders? Because motive doesn't equal murder. You know, I think at different times of our lives, we all may have a motive to want to kill someone, right? But we don't. So I don't know. That's where my mind's at now. But, you know, if I'm an 18, 19, 21-year-old kid that's hearing that this guy's running around with all these women and having an affair, oh, dude, he's guilty of sin, right?
Yeah.
But so I understand why they're doing it. But at the end of the day for me, I need to know what clues or what evidence puts him at the murder scene that's showing me that he did this.
And not all the time, but I think sometimes when prosecutors harp too much on the motive, they're trying to compensate for a lack of physical evidence. Not all the time, but that may have been the case here. They're one smoking gun, if you will. Their physical piece of evidence that you've been looking for, John, is the blood stains on David's shirt.
Yeah. And I mean, I would say that if I was a juror and I heard he's unfaithful to his wife and there's blood spatter from a close shot wound to his wife, guilty. Fry him.
The defense certainly argued that it was from brushing up to Jill's hair as he was removing Brad from the car. As for the timeline, prosecutors said that David sat out one basketball game, ran home, killed his family, and then returned to the church without anybody noticing and jumping back in the game. All 11 of the other men testified that they never saw David leave. They hadn't seen any blood on him at any time during playing, and they didn't notice any odd behavior or any change in behavior. Despite this alleged alibi, in 2002, a jury found David Cam guilty, and he was sentenced to 195 years in prison. John, I used to play a lot of pickup basketball, and I feel like if you left and did something this awful or saw something this awful, there would be a noticeable change.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going to be gone a lot longer than I think he would have been, you know, what they said he was gone.
Yeah.
I mean, at my age, I'm probably going to have to play a game of basketball and then set one out. Maybe I'm going to go use the restroom for 20 minutes and rethink my life. But no, I see this timeline as questionable.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
In August of 2004, the Indiana Court of Appeals actually overturned his conviction. They cited that the decision to allow testimony from the dozen women who claimed they had an affair with David was basically causing an unfair bias for the jury. Because, like we said, these relationships were not tied to the murders. Are they okay? Absolutely not. Does it make him a murderer? Also, absolutely not. A few months later, state prosecutors refiled charges against David. And for the new trial, the DNA on the sweatshirt was finally ran through CODIS, and a match was discovered. Now, if you're listening closely, I said earlier that they said they ran this through CODIS. But the guy who was supposedly the one responsible for doing that didn't actually do it. So it was like a, oops, I meant to do that. I forgot.
So he just didn't run it through CODIS.
Right.
Like he was supposed to.
So now that it has been ran through CODIS, there was actually a match that was discovered. And that's where we meet a guy named Charles Bonet. Now, Bonet was an 11-time convicted felon known as the Shoe Bandit. And he was known to have a foot fetish and a history of attacking women and stealing their shoes. Jamie, he also had another nickname. You want to take a guess at what that was?
No.
The Backbone.
Which was on the sweatshirt.
Yep.
There you go. Yeah, it's so unfortunate that the person did not run this through. And yeah, that's, I don't know. I wonder if this is bad enough to lose your job, because it could have prevented a lot of tax dollars from being spent, a lot of people put through these hearings. However, that doesn't stop the prosecution from pushing forward with David. Bonet had been in the system for years, so this match proved that there had been a sloppy investigation. Bonet had been in prison, where he had received that nickname you mentioned, Backbone, and he was out on parole at the time of the murder of the Cam family. He had been in prison for a series of armed attacks on women. Several involved theft, mostly of shoes. The most recent attack was armed robbery and an attempted abduction of three women at gunpoint. Very violent man, focused on hurting women. And again, this foot and shoe fetish is so odd. But if you think back to those shoes that were on top of the car, could have been removed to have access to Kim's feet. And she had bruises and cuts on the top of both of her feet. Bonet was brought down to the police station. He was interviewed and, of course, denied all involvement in this murder and in this crime. He claimed that he had donated the sweatshirt to the Salvation Army and said that it must have gotten picked up by David or whoever else committed this crime, because it wasn't him. He took a polygraph test and failed it, but they still cleared him as a suspect.
How? I don't understand that.
Well, I don't know. Like, I tried to come up with a reason just now, and I was like, well, there wasn't physical. Yeah, his DNA was at the scene on this sweatshirt that he said he donated. If he had donated that, I would think/hope they washed those before they put them out. So I would think that many people's DNA would not be on this sweatshirt.
Well, it turns out there was more physical evidence against Bonet. His palm print was actually found on Kim's vehicle. And then once that discovery was made, he was eventually arrested. Now, the female DNA on the sweatshirt was found to be Bonet's girlfriend that he had at the time. And I feel like that disproves the theory that he gave this sweatshirt to the Salvation Army and then allegedly David picked it up. I mean, yeah, that's ridiculous.
This is a newer relationship that would have happened. He would have donated it before he got with this woman.
Yeah. She was interviewed and told authorities that he came home after midnight the night of the murders, and he had a scraped up and bloody knee. She said that he was breathing really hard and just was somewhat excited. She said that he showed her a gun and told her to watch the news to see about the murders. All of this is just so damning to me.
It is. And I think he makes it worse by the story that he comes up with. And he told several different stories, but this is what he ultimately landed on. He said he and David met while he was out on parole at a pickup basketball game. After the game, David had been talking trash to him about the basketball game, and Bonet replied with, "I'm just glad to be a free man." And Bonet said that after David found out that he was a felon, David started asking him about buying a gun, specifically a gun that couldn't be traced with no serial numbers. Bonet says that they made arrangements through a few more meetings of getting together and talking about this, but they had never planned out when to exchange the guns. They had never talked on the phone. They just happened to see each other every now and then. This kept coming up. Bonet went to David's house around 7 p.m. on the night of the murder to finally sell him this gun that they had been talking about for weeks. He says that he gave David the gun. It was wrapped in his gray sweatshirt. And that's when he says Kim came home and essentially saw them in the middle of this transaction. Bonet said that David followed the car into the garage, pulled the gun out, and he heard three shots. Then David allegedly turned the gun on Bonet, saying, "You did this." Bonet said the gun jammed when he tried to shoot Bonet and that he chased David into the garage. And that's when David went into the house. Bonet tripped over Kim's shoes and then picked them up to put them on the car so he wouldn't trip over them again. Bonet went on to say that he leaned onto the vehicle to check on the kids to look in and see if they were okay. And that's how his palm print got there. And aside from this story, there's no evidence that David and Bonet had ever met or connected. So he's saying that he came to sell him a gun. David lured him into the garage to blame it on him. And his DNA was there because that's what he brought the gun in. The handprints because he's checking on the kids. He touched the shoes because he tripped over them. Like, this is the very epitome of wrapping a story around evidence, but it just happens to be a ridiculous story, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only critical part missing, if this is true, is, oh, yeah, and I called 911 to report that I'd just seen this man kill his entire family, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, come on. So even though Bonet's story doesn't line up with the autopsy time of death or eyewitness statements saying that Kim and the kids were at the pool until 7:15 p.m., David and Bonet were tried separately as co-conspirators. So David's not off the hook with this. He is still being tried. Bonet's trial wrapped up very quickly. He was convicted of murder and sentenced to 225 years in prison. David's trial started on January 17th of 2006, but now it had been ruled that the affairs were inadmissible, so the prosecution needed to come up with a new motive. And this is just awful, and if you have any aversion to hearing about sexual abuse, this may be hard to hear.
Just hit that 30-second skip button.
Yeah, maybe a couple times because I'm long-winded, but during the autopsy, the medical examiner did note that little Jill had experienced blunt force trauma to her genitals sometime within the past 24 hours leading up to her death. So they used this evidence to claim that David had been molesting his daughter and then killed his entire family to cover up the molestation.
David's defense at this trial brought in a medical examiner to refute the state's examiner's testimony and to disagree with the state's theory, saying that blunt force trauma was not necessarily from sexual abuse. It could have been from many injuries that could have taken place during the attack. The prosecution also presented Bonet's story that David was the shooter. So they brought Bonet in to tell this story about what happened. So the jury got to hear this ridiculous tale of how Bonet was pulled into the murder. Yet they still found David guilty for a second time, and this was on March 3rd of 2006. They claimed that they were swayed by the testimony from the forensic pediatrician with the Kentucky Medical Examiner's Office, who claimed Jill had been molested by her father, and if he was willing to molest her, then he was willing to kill them to cover it up, and he would be sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. So convicted for the second time, this time with maybe less evidence and motive than the first.
This is awful. And, you know, there's no doubt in my mind that she was sexually molested in some way. However, without DNA from the scene pointing to David and without her being able to testify that it was David, you really stand to question, you know, isn't it also possible that Bonet would have sexually assaulted her? we know that he had this foot fetish. Do you think that it stopped or started and stopped there? I don't know, man, this is just so hard to hear. And really, in my mind, outlandish to think that both of these guys were there and co-conspirators with each other.
Yeah. I mean,
what other evidence do we have to put them in connection with each other? And there's nothing.
Yeah, I completely agree. And that's why I think David's second conviction was, I don't know, not inexcusable, maybe inexcusable, but just unfathomable to me that you're going to believe Bonet's story. I just, that is really tough for me to hear. If you think that David did it based on the other evidence, then maybe agree to disagree on that. But to believe Bonet is wild to me.
Yeah. So David, of course, appealed this decision and conviction. And this time he cited the prejudicial nature of the molestation allegations and the lack of evidence linking him to those injuries on her. The Indiana Supreme Court overturned the conviction in 2009, saying the prosecution biased the jury by alleging David molested his daughter without sufficient evidence that he had, in fact, committed that crime. So they ordered a third trial.
With a third trial comes a third motive. The first motive was infidelity. The second was to cover up the molestation of his daughter. This one was life insurance, saying that he had policies that were recently put in place and that Kim had taken out insurance policies on the entire family. Bonet, once again, was brought in to testify against David, accusing him of luring him into the home before shooting his own family and then turning the gun on him. The trial also included DNA evidence that was not presented at the first two trials. The defense team was able to get a hold of touch DNA, which this, I think, became pretty popular with the Stephen Avery case. Basically, it's you don't have to have blood or semen. If somebody leaves skin cells on something that they touch, you can check that for DNA. And the defense was able to produce samples of touch DNA consistent with Bonet that was found on Kim's underwear, on the arm of her shirt above an injury that was thought to have happened during this murder, and on her broken fingernail, as well as the stomach of baby Jill's shirt. So his touch DNA was all over the victims, which totally refutes his story of tripping over the shoes and leaning into the car. It shows contact with Jill and Kim. Now, originally Bonet had said that he never touched the victims, but this DNA was pretty good evidence otherwise. The defense argued that if the DNA was correct and Bonet physically touched the family and attacked them, that it's unlikely, improbable, that David was the shooter.
So this third trial also saw a gentleman that we talked about earlier named Robert Stites. He was the photographer from the original crime scene, and he testified in the defense of in the first two trials. But at this trial, he admitted that he had perjured himself in the first two trials. He was, quote-unquote, the expert who insisted the spots on David's shirt were from a high-velocity impact spray from shooting his family. Now, this was, again, the cornerstone of the probable cause that was used to arrest David in the first place, and his testimony was critical and crucial to the first two convictions. He had previously testified that he was an expert on blood spatter patterns, and he was an analyst and a professor at the Portland State University who was in the process of attaining a PhD. This time, though, he admitted that his credentials were fake. He claimed that the original prosecutor at the first trial, whose name was Stan Faith, helped create those fraudulent credentials for him. Fun fact, Stan Faith had also represented Charles Bonet in another case before this entire incident. Now, Stites said that he was sent to the crime scene to take photographs and to take notes, and somehow his notes were used in the probable cause affidavit with him being listed as the crime scene reconstructionist, but he was not, in fact, a reconstructionist. He said, quote, "In hindsight, I would have kept my mouth shut," end quote. Stites was not charged with perjury. I feel like he should have been, because he didn't do this just one time. He did it twice. He totally made up his credentials, or said that somebody else helped make them up, but he didn't deny his credentials. He went with it.
And the same goes for Stan Faith. I mean, it seems that he did at least have a role in orchestrating this fraudulent testimony. So now that the touch DNA put Bonet in more of an active role at the crime scene, not just somebody chasing David through the garage, the prosecution decided to introduce another theory. At the end of the third trial, they offered the idea that Bonet may have been the actual shooter, but that he was put up to it by David Kam. The judge allowed a controversial ruling that the jury instructions could include an instruction allowing the jury to find David guilty if they believe that he aided and abetted Bonet during the murders. That should be controversial, and it is seemingly very biased against David Kam, or at least for the prosecution. The defense objected to this, of course, noting that there was no evidence that David had ever been involved with Bonet or had ever met him outside of the courtroom where he testified against him twice. They also noted that the instruction violated double jeopardy laws, since David had already been acquitted on conspiracy charges during his second trial. The jury saw through the prosecution's strategy, and on October 4th of 2013, just over 10 years ago, they found David not guilty of all charges. He had been in prison for 13 years for the murder of his wife and two children, and he was finally free to go.
What a saga, man. Like, if this dude legitimately had nothing to do with his family's murder, this is one of the most insane cases I've ever heard of.
So I guess that's a good question. Do you think he was, or do you think he is innocent?
I don't think he is guilty at all. I think this is, I think he's a great guy? No, but that the infidelity doesn't mean that he murdered his family. I mean, would he probably have wanted to divorce his wife and get away from her for a little bit? Maybe at one point, but that, again, doesn't mean that he was capable of murder. So.
I agree with you. The physical evidence suggests that Bonet was there. We know he has a violent past. His DNA was found on Kim's underwear. That is beyond a reasonable doubt, in my opinion, that he's guilty, which means that David is not guilty. So I think they finally got it right in the third trial.
I really hope that that's all there is to this story, that it was Bonet and only Bonet. But I hope that years later we don't find out that David actually worked with Bonet to make this happen. I hope we don't find that out.
As of right now, there's no evidence to suggest that besides the prosecution saying it. So yeah. I think if that turns out to be the case, you're right. That would be awful. But there's nothing to suggest that right now.
Yeah. In May of 2014, David announced that he would be filing a suit against Floyd County and the state of Indiana. He ended up reaching a $4.6 million settlement in a federal lawsuit that included the lead investigator in the case, Robert Stites, and the forensic blood spatter expert, Robert Ingold. Now, Floyd County agreed to pay David $450,000, and in August of 2023, just a few months ago, a judge awarded David $3 million in a case and lawsuit against Charles Bonet, $1 million each for each family member that Bonet murdered.
Yeah, and obviously these suits were for the prosecution and the unlawful investigation that went against David, not, except for the lawsuit against Charles Bonet, that was for the loss of life of his family, but the other $4 to $5 million in settlements was directly for his incarceration. So not going to bring his family back, not going to give him those 13 years back, but hopefully gets him in a place where he can start to live a life outside of prison. Today, Charles Bonet is still in prison, serving his 225-year sentence, which I think is safe to say he will never get out. He maintains to this day that David was the shooter and that he had no role in killing Kim and the kids. Kim's parents agree with Bonet to this day. They still believe that David's responsible for the death of their daughter and the deaths of their grandchildren. Today, David works as a case coordinator for Investigating Innocence, a national nonprofit that provides criminal defense investigations for inmates who are still claiming that they are innocent. So putting his situation to work and trying to help people in a similar situation, what do you think about Kim's parents and their thoughts? I mean, early on, obviously, when he was being charged, Bonet wasn't even in the picture. I could totally see them buying into that. And maybe they just got so deep into that belief that nothing was going to convince them otherwise, which through the pain they've been in, I could totally get that. Not blaming them at all. I just find it interesting.
Yeah. I mean, if that's all you have to go on for quite some time, then that's probably so built up in your system, it's hard to get rid of that. You know, if I'm her parent, even if I know he wasn't the one who pulled the trigger, I still don't like the guy. I mean, right. He caused my daughter so much pain. My grandchildren are no longer here. My daughter's no longer here. Yeah, I'm going to hate David.
Yeah,
but,
I get it.
But I could also, once I learned that Bonet was involved, I could also hate him separately.
True.
So just a life full of hate. And I hope that for their sake, they're able to get the help they need to somehow process all this evil and move forward somehow, because it's a burden that's too heavy to carry.
For anybody. Absolutely. Guys, we appreciate you hanging out with us through this one. It was some things hard to hear, but absolutely fascinating from a legal standpoint, from what happened in court, from what happened in the investigation and throughout the case of David Cam for the murders of his family. So hope you found it as interesting as we did.
Guys, we appreciate you. And until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.